as anyone who's been following the caucuses knows, there's been a lot of very extreme statements made by the various Republican presidential candidates. It's been kind of a disheartening political season for those of us who recognize that the overwhelming majority of Muslims, not just in the United States, but around the world, don't buy into this sort of violence, jihad. You know, that's a fringe group.
Welcome to Local Talk, a show featuring people's stories and events in central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. Relatively good news for opponents of the Bakken crude oil pipeline. Yesterday afternoon, the three-member governor-appointed Iowa Utilities Board declined to take immediate action on the pipeline permit application, as many feared it would. On Monday through Thursday of this week, the Utilities Board held public deliberations, followed by a closed-door session. Rather than make an immediate decision, the board decided to resume deliberations next Friday and could make a decision then. Coming up later in the show, we are joined by Mary Rankin, Director of Sustainability at Iowa State, who always provides us fresh insights on what makes our community sustainable in the long run. We start, however, with a report on research at Iowa State into the news media's effect on public attitudes toward Muslims. Last week, a paper originating in the ISU Psychology Department came out in the journal Communications Research. I spoke with the lead author of the study, Distinguished Professor of Psychology Craig Anderson. Dr. Anderson explained that they had performed a pair of studies. The first was a simple survey that asked participants, among other questions, how frequently they watched news items that showed Muslims as terrorists, and then measured their attitudes on two factors: how supportive they were of military interventions in the Arab world, and how supportive they were of measures to curtail the civil liberties of Muslim Americans. As expected, they found a correlation between the behavior and the attitudes. But correlation, of course, does not imply causation. So next, the researchers did an experimental study where they assigned volunteers to different groups, manipulated their experiences, and observed the outcome. Here's Craig Anderson.
We randomly assigned a large number of research participants, all adults, to one of four different conditions. In one condition, they saw a brief news clip that reported on a Muslim-related terror incident in the U.S. Others were randomly assigned to view what we call a neutral clip. In fact, it was a story about how one of the school districts in the Detroit area decided to change football practice times to accommodate some of their Muslim students during Ramadan. A third group was shown what we think of as a counter-stereotypic kind of news clip. This was one reporting on a story out of the Detroit area in which a large number of Muslim Americans in that community were engaging in some volunteer activities over the Christmas season. And the news report sort of emphasized how both Muslim Americans and Christian Americans were coming together in a very positive way. And then the fourth group didn't see any of these news clips. They just went right to the measures. Everyone who saw news clips about Muslim Americans, before they actually saw the news clips that were experimentally manipulated between condition, all of them saw two totally irrelevant news clips in keeping with the cover story that they're going to be evaluating a number of different things. You know, in the measurement part that took place after the experimental manipulation, there were a lot of other questions that were not specifically related to Muslim Americans, again, to help kind of initially disguise what the study's really about. You know, we measured several things in this study, three particular importance. One was a measure of the extent to which the research participant tended to perceive Muslims as inherently violent or aggressive. The other two measures were support for military action against Muslim countries and support for restricting the civil rights of Muslim Americans. And what we found was that the Muslim terrorist video clip, news story essentially, led to an increase in the perception of Muslim Americans as aggressive, It also led to an increase in support for military action in Muslim countries and an increase in support for restricting the civil rights of Muslim Americans. The sort of positive story about Muslim Americans had the opposite effect. That is, it decreased the perception of Muslims as being inherently aggressive, decreased support for military action in Muslim countries, and decreased support for restricting the civil rights of Muslim Americans. And because this was an experimental study, we can say with a high degree of confidence that these news report effects were in fact caused by the news reports.
The implications of Craig Anderson's study are clear. News items affect the belief systems of their consumers, and a news industry that focuses solely on the crimes or violence of any group helps to foster prejudice in the public about that group. And this is not the first research of this type that Craig Anderson and his colleagues in the Iowa State Psychology Department have published. They've done quite a lot of research on the effects of media, especially violent media, on its consumers. And when a Muslim American graduate student from Ohio, Muniba Salim, joined their team, she has since left for an appointment at the University of Michigan, they turned their focus on portrayals of Muslims in particular.
We actually published a study a few years ago which showed that playing a terrorism-based video game in which the player is a counterterrorist playing the role of a U.S. military counterterrorism expert attacking Muslim terrorists. Other conditions, we actually had a Russian terrorist condition that was the same as the Arab terrorist, except that instead of being in a desert setting, it was set in a winter setting in a big city. We also had several other experimental conditions playing video games that are, you know, nonviolent and so on. And basically what this actually a pair of experimental studies showed was that even briefly playing a terrorism-type video game increases anti-Arab attitudes and beliefs and emotional reactions, even compared to playing a violent game, but one that has no Arabs or terrorism theme to it. So basically, you know, a lot of the most popular video games these days are war-based games, very often counterterrorism kind of games, and they almost all in the U.S., the bad guys are Arab terrorists. Interestingly, if you go to the Middle East, in certain parts of the Middle East, they have essentially the same game with the American invaders as the terrorists. So it's kind of a strange phenomenon, but you know, it fits well with what we've known about TV violence effects, movie violence effects, and so on for many, many years, that these kinds of stories essentially have an impact. And they have an impact in ways that the person who's consuming the stories, whether it's in a video game format or a news story, you know, very often don't realize that they're being affected in that way. One of the broader points we like to make is we want to make people aware that these things do have an impact, even if you don't recognize it or feel it. And it can have an impact that leads to a splintering of U.S. society rather than sort of bringing different groups together.
Talking with Dr. Anderson at the Iowa State Psychology Department, you know, caused me to reflect upon the anti-Muslim sentiments and suspicions that were being peddled by presidential candidates in Iowa and which appeared to be drawing support. And this was not just one candidate. For instance, Trump's statement that he would ban all Muslims from entering the United States were echoed by Republican Senator Ted Cruz and Governor Jeb Bush's statements that we should ban Syrian refugees who are Muslim while welcoming those who were Christians. Of course, Cruz had the quote about carpet bombing Syria and all of the innocent people there. Senator Marco Rubio stated his intent to close down, quote, not just mosques, but any facility that is being used to inspire radicalism. And Ben Carson said that the United States should never have a Muslim president. And we found out that this week that two-thirds of New Hampshire's Republican primary voters this week stated they support a ban on Muslims entering the U.S. So given all of that, I asked Dr. Anderson about his reflections on these matters.
The timing on this research paper coming out, especially in Iowa, during the Iowa presidential caucuses is quite a coincidence, maybe fortuitous. As anyone who's been following the caucuses knows, there's been a lot of very extreme statements made by the various Republican presidential candidates. Extreme stereotype, prejudice-based statements about immigrants, about Muslims. It's been kind of a disheartening political season for those of us who recognize that the overwhelming majority of Muslims, not just in the United States, but around the world, don't buy into this sort of violence, jihad type. You know, that's a fringe group. It's a very loud fringe group, and certainly we have to pay attention to that. But good, normal American citizens are being scapegoated quite a bit. And from some news reports, it looks as if this posturing by some of these presidential candidates has, in fact, led to an increase in attacks on Muslim Americans in a variety of ways. And that's both sad and frightening.
But based on your research, is that kind of what you might expect?
The research certainly suggests that this kind of scapegoating and some of the attacks on Muslim Americans after all this rhetoric from the Republican candidates, sure, we would expect that. I mean, that's what the research would show.
And that was Dr. Craig Anderson at Iowa State. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson. Well, here at KHOI, it is our mission to build community through communication, not to splinter, fragment, disenfranchise, or exclude groups through communication. So this got me thinking that I really wanted to check in with some of my Muslim neighbors. Mohammed Abu Falga is the press secretary for the Arab Students Association on campus, and this group was founded just 1 year ago under the advisorship of the Syrian lecturer in Arabic language that we had on Local Talk in December, Gwinha Alamin. The goal of the group is to share Arab culture and to clear up misconceptions about Arabs and Muslims. Mohammed came to this mission early in his time here at Iowa State. Here he describes one of the first experiences he had on campus back in 2014.
For my first semester, I was supposed to live on campus in the university housing. And I had an American roommate. When I met him, he told me after a while that before I came, he saw my name and it says Muhammad, and it's obvious that Muhammad is Muslim. So his family thought that it might be, I don't know, dangerous, or he might not be comfortable with me or something. I actually met his family, and I don't know, I hope that I correct their misconception about Muslims.
Where did they live?
I think they live in Ankeny.
So you went for a holiday, or?
Yeah, I think I went in Christmas for dinner with them. That was a great experience to have.
Did they ask you a lot of questions?
Kinda, yeah. But I was comfortable with that. I mean, people who don't know others, they have questions, and that's totally okay. And I'm not that guy who's sensitive about this problem. I'm just trying to correct as much as I can, and then present the actual reality of Muslims and Arabs.
Since Mohammed Abu Falga was clearly entertaining questions, I asked him about his practice of prayer and how it fit into his life as a student.
Yeah, I actually do pray 5 times a day. And then we have the Juma prayer, which is on Friday. It's a weekly prayer on Friday. And personally, I do practice. It helps me in somehow, but it doesn't make me different from the other people that I see here at Iowa State.
Of course not. So how do you make time or space for yourself to pray?
I usually come to campus in the morning and stay the whole day until sometimes the midnight, but I spend most of my time in the library. And in Islam, we don't have like to go to the mosque to pray, so it's open for us like to choose wherever we want to pray. And I usually do that in the library. It's just a matter of picking a quiet place where we don't distract anyone else like from studying.
And is it a silent prayer?
It depends. We have five prayers, like the one in the morning, that's usually we pray it at home before we come to the campus. And then we have two silent prayers. And then we have two prayers that are not silent. They're not silent, but we can pray it in a way that doesn't sound loud. And we try like to do whatever fits in the place where we pray.
So I asked Mohammed how he felt about the political climate as revealed by the Republican presidential candidates coming through Ames.
First of all, since I'm not American, I don't know if I'm allowed to say my opinion about the candidates, but some of them, yes, they are saying bad things about Muslims. And it really hurts, like, when you hear someone just, like, saying things, and he's just like saying things based on stereotypes, and it hurts more when you look at the Muslim Americans who have been living here for decades, and they have contributed to the country, and then you hear some presidential candidate saying that those are danger or threat to the country. For me, it makes me feel bad sometimes, but being surrounded by students who are generally are educated, it just makes me think that those candidates who are saying such stuff, they don't represent the real American who are aware of the reality about Muslims and Islam.
So let's just hear a little bit about you, the person, instead of you, the Arab Muslim. You're studying aerospace engineering.
Yeah, I'm studying aerospace engineering, and I'm doing a minor in political science.
Why aerospace engineering, and why political science? Very different.
Yeah, they actually very different. I was I'm sponsored by the Libyan government, And I felt that it's one of my responsibilities is to work in a field that we don't have much of. At the beginning, I was studying medicine, and then I changed my path because I thought that like there are so many doctors in Libya, but there's just few aerospace engineers. So that was a good way to work for the country. And for political science, I've been following the politics like since I was in middle school or something. So I thought that studying political science in the US would be a great chance to let me like know about how the world works, because you know US is the superpower here in this era, and it's like the center of politics. So that was a good chance to learn about the world.
Well, Libya, your home country, had a lot of changes recently. We were talking that it was part of the Arab Spring, a bloody battleground for democracy. And what are your thoughts on the future of politics and government in Libya?
I don't know. It's been ongoing problems for a while now. It's for 4 years or 5 years. I hope that the future will be better, but sometimes I feel like it's just a normal transition from an authoritarian government or authoritarian rule to a democratic rule. But it actually took 5 years now. And I mean, it's still like Libyan somehow is better than some other countries like Syria, for example. But at the same time, it's not as good as we hope. It's not as good as we hoped back in 2011. And now it's just politics game, but the problem is that our politicians, they don't have the deep experience to take the country from war to peace.
Yeah, we have our own problems with democracy here in the United States. What do you think are some of the biggest challenges for democracy in the Arab world?
Most of the Arab countries have been ruled by dictators for a while. So that affected the culture, I mean the political culture. So it actually takes time to transit the public culture from the authoritarian thoughts or from the authoritarian theory to the democratic theory. And this is one of the problems, the political culture, that the people are not deeply aware of democracy and its importance to help them live and help them improve their living. And at the same time, there are some of the normal democratic problems, problems that happen all over the world, when big corporations get into politics and it manipulates the process. So that's one of the problems also.
What are some of the big corporations that are in Libya?
There are some corporations that were supported by the previous government, the authoritarian government, and there are some businessmen who were sponsored or supported by the government, and they are now contributing money to some specific politicians to try to put obstacles in face of the democratic transition in Libya. And they also support or sponsor some of the war machine, and the war game is always making profit for them. So they are trying to make it last as much as they can. They had contacts with the previous regime, and that was one of the problems. They know when you have a democratic country where the law rules everything, they're gonna be brought back to Libya and then they will go to trials and that stuff. So no one wanna go to trial, you know. So that what happens. They are just airing the war and they're trying to make it last.
So when you go back to Libya with your degrees, do you hope to contribute to the democratization as well as to the aerospace field?
That's a good question. My wide goal, or my main goal, is to work for a better nation, for Libyans. And I will see when I go back home, which way is faster in order to improve the quality of life. If it was working in aerospace field, I'm going to work in aerospace. And if I found that I should work in politics, I'm going to get to politics. That's why I'm studying minor here, so I have two options when I go back home.
Have you been home since you came to the United States to study?
No, I came in February 2014, and I haven't gone back home yet. That's a problem with Libya because we have only one entry visa, so it's difficult to go back and then get another visa. And you know, with the problems going on in Libya, I don't think it's easy to get a visa.
There's concern that maybe the United States government would limit your entrance here.
Yeah, that's the main concern. So we can't guarantee that we will get a visa to come back and finish, if we have one or two or three semesters left. So it's better to finish and then get back.
So you share Arab culture with Iowa State students and the broader community. What do you miss most about the Arab culture being separated from your home for so long?
Of course, one of the biggest things that I miss is the food. I also miss the Libyan events, the Arab events, the social events like weddings and that kind of parties. Of course, I miss my family. I miss the gathering of my family. And I don't know, I miss the Libyan community where everyone knows everyone and that kind of society.
Very social.
Yeah, very social people. And it's not the same here. I mean, I do like the US and everything, but it's kind of different where people speak Arabic. Is my native language, where I can talk without being afraid of being linguistically wrong or pronouncing some words in a wrong way. it's kind of limiting my interactions with people. But back there in Libya, it's...
You can be yourself.
Yeah. That's the word for it. Yeah.
Well, you've done very well in this interview, Mohammed. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I hope that you and your audience get something about the Arabs or the Arabic culture from this interview.
And that was Mohammed Abu Falga, the press secretary of the Arab Students Association at ISU. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Mohammed was a very gracious young man, as you could hear, only 21 years old. We wish him the best, and we will hear back from him in March when his group is planning an Arab night celebrating Arab culture to which the public will be invited. Well, to continue this theme, here is Hamza El-Din, a Nubian oud player, with a Valentine's Day song for us.
La salam la jawa يا عز حبيبي ايه هالاسباب عن عيني تغيب لا سلام لا جواب يا عز حبيبي ايه هالاسباب عن عيني تغيب كتير كتير سألت عليك رسلت وجيت علشان ألاقيك كتير كتير سألت عليك رسلت وجيت علشان ألاقيك يا الشاغل بالي سهر الليالي والشوق يا غالي هم دليل حبي وفايدي لشوق قلبي
was Hamza El-Din on the oud and vocals. This main character in the song offers these words to his elusive beloved. There's no hello from you, no letters, my sweetheart. I would do anything to know the reason why. I ask around about you a lot, where are you, and so forth. But no one knows. I cannot find you. I spend the whole night thinking about you and where you might be. We'll have more Valentine's Day coverage at the end of this hour. An interview with Boone Community Theater actor Nick Julesgaard talking about what it's like to play the role of Adam opposite your wife's Eve. Stay tuned for that. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. You may recall that the Monday before last was the Iowa caucus, and you may know that on Monday night, KHOI hosted a live broadcast of analysis and results. It was my great privilege to co-host this four-hour show with a seasoned Pacifica Radio newsman from Madison, Wisconsin, Norm Stockwell. This is my first Local Talk show since that evening, and somehow it's still hard to let go of presidential politics. Of course, on Tuesday, New Hampshire provided us fresh food for thought with a decisive win by Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary there. Well, speaking of New Hampshire, we had the opportunity on that past Monday night to talk to many national commentators here, and as well as at least a dozen volunteers from our station and across Iowa about what they were witnessing. But my favorite moment was provided by a voice that will be familiar to listeners of both KHOI and Iowa Public Radio, Arnie Arneson. Arnie is a recovering politician, as she calls it, a former New Hampshire legislator who loves to talk politics. Her show, The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, airs every Monday on this radio station, KHOI Community Radio, at 4 p.m. So in the course of talking with Arnie on caucus night, she shared this story about ground zero of the Sanders presidential campaign there in New Hampshire, her home state, just a little over 1 year ago. Let's take a listen.
What you don't know is I'll send you a picture every once in a while. You can put it up on the radio station website. Bernie, I've known him forever. In January of last year, Bernie calls me up because he knows that the house that I live in Concord has hosted lots of presidential candidates on both sides of the aisle, everyone. On both sides of the aisle. The former owner of this house, it was a mixed marriage. She was a powerful Republican. He was a powerful Democrat, a friend of Bill. I married a libertarian atheist Republican, and I'm a liberal Democrat. Okay, so that should just give you an idea. We continue the tradition. And he calls me up in January of 2015 and says, can I borrow the house? And I said, why? He said, I'm thinking of running for president. And I'm like, really? And I said, now remember, Bernie, I'm in the media. I'm not endorsing anyone, but I've always held out that this house will be open and available to presidents in waiting. If you want to borrow the house, you can borrow the house. I'm not going to lift a finger. Bernie borrows the house in the middle end of January, and out of nowhere, everyone, 150 people show up at my house. 150 people for Bernie in January of 2015. And we're all looking like, where did they come from? And then I was the jerk in the room, everyone. Because as he's talking, his shtick that you hear him today talking about, I said to him, I'm going to ask you the $64,000 question, Bernie, because you haven't answered it yet. And he looks at me and goes, what's the question, Arnie? Which party? And he gets really quiet. And then I know him very well, everyone. And I said to him, Bernie, if you don't answer a party, you might as well leave the house. And it took him a couple of minutes to say the word Democrat, but he did. It happened in my house. I want people to hear that that's how it started. And even when he was just feeling it out and throwing it up in the air like a trial balloon, where did they come from? I'd never seen anything like it, everyone. And it shocked me, and I know my state like the back of my hand.
And that was Arnie Arneson of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Her show on politics and feminism airs at 4 p.m. on Mondays on KHOI. And we will indeed have that photo of the Concord House on our website when this show is posted. You are listening to Local Talk on 89.1 FM KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson, and with me in the studio now are Mary Rankin, the Director of Sustainability Programs at Iowa State University, and an intern, Catherine Lydahl, a senior in political science who has been working with Mary on the Live Green Project. Mary, welcome to you.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I almost feel I've come to know you through your several interviews with my colleague Jim Werbel, but it's nice to meet you in person.
Yeah, it's really fun.
And Catherine, hello to you.
Hello, good morning.
Welcome to our station.
Thank you.
So here on Local Talk, Mary always shares with us perspectives on sustainability. Lately, you've been talking about efforts to elevate the profile of Iowa State University as an exemplary institution when it comes to environmental sustainability. You want to make Iowa State a star?
Well, yes, I'm always interested in making Iowa State a star in many ways, besides sustainability, of course. But the star that you mention is related to a really unique opportunity of highlighting and celebrating the commitment and dedication specifically to sustainability at colleges and universities. This is actually an international certification program, and STARS stands for Sustainability Tracking Assessment Rating System. STARS very much exemplifies the fact that sustainability really is more than just environmental pieces. And the STARS certification really focuses on the sustainability pieces from a standpoint of social sustainability, financial sustainability, and certainly environmental sustainability.
And you shared with me a website that we will share with our listeners. It was very interesting to poke around at that website. It's a place where you've been recording the various efforts that Iowa State makes. And Catherine's nodding her head. I'm assuming that she's been doing a lot of this recording as an intern. But you can find out all of the different categories by which Iowa State is judged, or all colleges are judged on their sustainability and how we're doing in each of those categories.
And, you know, we initially started out not to be a part of the official sort of what is your certification level. We really approached this in the initial beginning as a benchmarking process for us to personally look at all this breadth and depth of sustainability and where we have gone, you know, over the years. And then, of course, when we got into it, we thought, hey, we want to put our name out there because we're really excited about what we're doing. And so that's when we went in, and that's when we eventually got a gold certification. And since that time, then the certification is good for 3 years. And so now we're coming back up on the 3-year mark. And so we're gathering all the pieces together again.
Where have there been changes?
Well, I think, you know, a few of the areas that we have been particularly proud and excited about, certainly if you look at the growth we've had on our campus and then compare that to energy consumption, water use, waste production, you know, it hasn't been an even growth per capita. And so we've been very excited about that. I mean, that really lends to the commitment and the dedication that our staff and our teams have, you know, that oversee our different operations around campus and really being very dedicated to ensuring that we can be as efficient as possible in those areas. So that's very exciting. We're also very excited about the fact of the opportunities that we are able to offer our students in their Iowa State experience. And that includes classes. It includes even research opportunities to be involved with sustainability research and also getting engaged in the community. And so volunteerism related to – that's something very important for STARS. How involved are our students in the community? What opportunities do they have in the classroom? What opportunities do they have related to immersion experiences? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those hands-on, being in location, you know, putting sustainability principles into action. We have been very, very excited that all of our colleges on campus, I think – not sure what the percentage is now, at least 90% of our departments offer classes that are either sustainability related or focused, and we have a diversity of immersion activities both in the classroom and outside of the classroom. So those are particularly exciting.
Yeah. Well, I noticed on the website that the instruction category of on this STARS compliance list was mm-hmm. really one of the – I think you got 100% of those points.
We did, yes.
That was very exciting. That was neat. And mm-hmm. and I – that's actually a place where I did kind of click and mm-hmm. see mm-hmm. – go
of
another
course.
Level and see what was going on. And I found out about this learning community, a dorm on campus. Can you tell us about it?
Well, learning communities are, gosh, such an important part of the history of Iowa State University. We've really done the learning community opportunity, I think, very, very mm-hmm. well. And that's just, you know, when you come in to Iowa State, you have a group of peers that you are immediately attached to that are in the same field of study, possibly, same area of interest. And it's sort of, you know, your group to grow with, to experience, and to have that those common connections, too. And so learning community doesn't necessarily imply living community.
Okay.
However, over time, we have done learning and living communities. We've done that in Program for Women in Science and Engineering, I yep. believe, has one. And Catherine might know some others because we didn't have learning communities when I went to Iowa State. So this is super exciting. But the sustainability living and learning community is a brand new one that we started, gosh, I think it's been 3 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And it you know, sustainability is one of those interesting things where it means different things to different people. And so it took a little bit of time for, I think, a lot of connections to be made. But now it's really thriving. I've gone and talked to the learning community the last couple of years, and there's such a wide diversity of students, particularly from interest and what education pathway that they're pursuing. And it's really, really exciting because it really, really does embrace what a real sustainable, you know, sort of community should be.
Well, and it's so interesting to see these students who maybe come from diverse backgrounds but all care about sustainability kind of feeding off each other's ideas and finding innovative ways to incorporate sustainability into their major or their future. So it's a wonderful thing we have on campus.
Well, Catherine, how did you get pulled into the sustainability world and become an intern now as a senior in political science?
Absolutely. So I ended up interning for Mary this past summer and working on various projects and such during the summertime. And that's when STARS was first introduced to me as an intern. So going through this wonderful 300-page, you know, document and really diving into you know, what all incorporated, I realized that sustainability wasn't necessarily, you know, the tree-hugging, I guess, MO that it usually gets from a lot of people. It's really a umbrella term, and it really incorporates so many different variables that, you know, I had no idea. And it was so interesting to see the, especially with STARS, the emphasis it had on student life and you know, the other elements it incorporated, not just recycling, so...
This is Local Talk on KHOI. We're talking with Mary Rankin and with Catherine Lydell, a senior in political science, about this STARS sustainability tracking assessment and rating system that the Iowa State University is engaging in to watch itself grow in sustainable ways. Let's talk about some other of the categories that are on there. I was very interested in the food part.
Mm-hmm. Sure, of course.
So there's many dimensions of food
right. And
food service that we might not think about right away, but that involve sustainability issues. For instance, just a very small 0.25 rated item is trayless dining.
Right.
Have you achieved trayless dining?
Absolutely. In all of our residential dining centers, we are trayless now. When you walk into the union, you still might see, you know, some trays running around. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, in all of our trayless dining, we are that has happened in our residential dining facilities. And so the whole idea with trayless dining is to its huge impact. There's a health impact and certainly a waste impact. So the waste impact is that if you have a tray to pile all this stuff on, you will be more likely to take more food than maybe you can possibly eat. And the health aspect of that is that do you really need, you know, to take all of those pieces? Some of them, of course, I can throw this beautiful looking piece of pie on or, you know, whatever. And so instead, we have it as sort of a just-in-time system. So you go and you get your plate at whatever station. We have a number of different stations around, so it's not just the same walkthrough everybody has. And so you take, you know, your plate and you fill your plate up at a particular station. You take that back and you have to make then the decision whether or not you make the effort to go again and get another plate. And what we have found is that people sit down, they eat what they have, and then they think, gosh, I guess I'm not really as hungry as I thought I was. And, you know, it can end at a plate. And we initially tested this in between two dining centers, found that there was a 40% difference in waste food from the dining facility that, you know, had trayless versus the ones that had trays.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So another issue with food is where you source your food, according to the STARS.
Right. And so, you know, an important part of sustainability is economic sustainability, which, of course, that is being as financially responsible as you can with the money you have. But it's also how do you grow and empower and strengthen the community around you, right? So there is that strengthening of local economy and supporting of local economy. And so a piece of that that really can impact the student experience is food. And so how do we allow students to experience different types of food that are local to us, supporting the local economy, of course, reducing the carbon footprint of you know, bringing food from all different corners. And so we've worked really hard at Iowa State to work with a number of local producers to source different types of food at different times of the year. We're a little more challenged
our
climate, right? because, gosh, when we have all the bounty of of what we can grow. Usually it's when most of our students aren't here. Mm-hmm. However, our dining services has been so proactive and so thoughtful in getting materials, processing them, freezing them to use at other times, and also incorporating little bits and pieces of things, even though it may not be in quantity, but little bits and pieces of things where they can. And they do a great job of then giving credit and getting that awareness built. So there's signage, you know, by these different dishes saying this, you know, this is a local product. It's come from this area and that kind of thing. And our students have really been very receptive and very excited of experiencing those different foods and knowing that they are being a part of supporting, you know, a local farmer, local producer.
Yeah, it's really wonderful what our dining services are doing to make us kind of informed consumers, even within our own dining centers.
Right. And then a final food topic.
Yes.
The food bank. I did not know that there was a food bank on campus.
Our students are so amazing. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, I was approached by some students saying they were looking at starting a food bank for students on campus. And so they did. They kicked it off, and it's a student organization, actually, that does this. And so student organizations, you know, they sort of ebb and flow according to when students graduate and who mm-hmm. comes in and all that sort of thing. This organization has remained really strong, and in fact, in February, this month, they are celebrating their 5th birthday. And they are having a whole number of different events on campus to get different awareness and exposure out about increasing engagement and interaction with the food bank. But a couple of things that I wanted to mention while I'm on the air is they will be collecting. They collect donations year round, and it's non-perishable food, but mm-hmm. also some toiletry items and stuff that students tend to need. It's a no questions asked opportunity for our students. So this week in particular, they're offering a number of donations, and they will be doing an open house actually on February 18th from 3 to 6 p.m. in 2615 Food Sciences Building if anyone wants to attend and learn more about it. But on an average week, Greta, they serve 60 to 90 students, and they're open 13 hours of operation, and they use 230 student volunteers. This is a really strong, wonderful mm-hmm. support system for our students by students.
Oh, that's wonderful. We'll have information about that event on our website
right.
when we post this show.
Yeah, and the group's name is The Shop, so to
cool.
make that easy to remember.
All right, well, Mary, we've run out of time already.
Oh, my gosh.
And we barely scratched the surface of this wonderful document that you put together. So I encourage our listeners to go to that webpage and see what's going on at Iowa State. And, of course, we'll have you back again next month to tell us more.
That sounds absolutely wonderful. Yes, there's a lot going on at Iowa State that I think people don't even realize mm-hmm. what we are trying to look at and improve on a day-to-day basis.
Thanks. And thank you, Catherine Lydell, for coming
Excellent.
In.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, finally, for those of you looking for the perfect date this weekend or next, Boone Community Theater just may have the ticket. Our local talk reporter for the 10-county listening area, Susan Franzen, spoke with Nick Julesgaard of Boone, who, together with his wife Kelly, are starring in the production The Diaries of Adam and Eve, based on the writing of Mark Twain, which the company advertises as a lighthearted look at the first love story. Here's Susan Franzen with Nick Julesgaard.
Last time you were here, I believe you were the producer of Barefoot in the Park.
That's correct. I was the producer, and my wife, Kelly, was the director. And now we've swapped roles, and we are actually playing Adam and Eve, the two characters in this Diaries of Adam and Eve.
Well, now, this is a Mark Twain play,
mm-hmm.
but I wasn't originally written as a play. Is that right?
No, that's right. Actually, it's interesting. Mark Twain wrote The Diary of Adam fairly early in his life, and then he ended up writing The Diary of Eve much later as a kind of a companion piece, but it has a much different tone because it's after the death of his child. And so Dave Burney put these two together into a play form where the monologues, these kind of diary entries of Adam and Eve, overlap, and it makes a really nice story with completely drenched with Twainish kind of, you know, wisdom. So it's very funny, very Mark Twain, but it flows together as a nice play.
Now, I would think this might have some costuming problems.
Yes. Let me make it perfectly clear that we will not be wearing fig leaves. That's not what's happening here. We're costumed in the era of Mark Twain. So late 19th century kind of clothing. Fully clothed, very family friendly.
Is it fun to be playing Adam and Eve with your wife?
It is illuminating. Because Adam and Eve have the same kind of problems that every couple have. And they start off as a new couple, and then they kind of go through their newlywed phase, and then they are adults. And so it's the story of their whole life. And so there's definitely moments that Kelly and I can connect with. And I think they come out on stage hopefully funny.
I know from when I was young, I used to be in some play readings with my husband. Mm-hmm. And we would discover that we were repeating whole sequences of the dialogue at home because it just felt natural.
Yes. Some of it feels a little too natural. The argumentative stuff kind of sometimes feels appropriate. So I say argumentative because they have a lot of – the idea is that it's diary entries. So you're talking about the first day in the garden, and then you talk about the first time you see Eve, and then – how much of a distraction she is. And she's talking about how exciting it is to hear him speak for the first time. And so there's a lot of fun discovery. It's a lot of exploring the world as a very new thing.
How did you pick this play for Boone Community Theater?
Oh, I wish I could take credit, but I can't. It was John Hoffman. So our president of our theater, who's the director for this play, has known this play for a while, and he thought it would be appropriate. So
working with you and Kelly, he thought right away of you, or did you have extensive tryouts?
We definitely auditioned. That's the thing with Boone Theater is we don't precast. So we had to try out, and we went through the whole process, and we were lucky enough to get it.
Were there any discoveries in this play for you besides the fact that it's apparently quite reminiscent of a real marriage?
Were there any discoveries? Well, I discovered that when you read Mark Twain, you just have to keep going because there's always so much depth in what he does. First time we read this play, I thought, I don't know if this is going to work. It's just the way he writes is so dense. And then as you rehearse it and as you read it over and over and you say it out loud, you realize that there's just so much good material there. He is such an intelligent, dense-worded writer. So there's so much. And the play is only 90 minutes, but it feels like more than that because there's just so much material in it. And it plays fast and it plays fun, but it feels like a full two-hour play. So.
Now, would you give the dates and times now for people?
Absolutely. This weekend, it's going to be on the 12th and the 13th. Dinner Theater, which is closed, starts at 6. But if you'd like to come see the show this weekend on the 12th and the 13th, Friday and Saturday, we will have doors open, and you can buy tickets at the door or online at 7. And then next weekend, the weekend after this coming one, which is the 19th and the 20th, Friday night is a 7 o'clock show, and then there's two shows on Saturday, a matinee and then a regular show at 7. And you can buy all those tickets online, boonecommunitytheater.org, and you can also buy them at the door, cash or credit card. Everything's accepted.
And that's Nick Julesgaard from Boone Community Theater. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. We started out the show with Distinguished Professor of Psychology at ISU, Craig Anderson, describing his recent research on attitudes towards Muslims, which came out last week in the journal Communications Research. He was followed by the spokesperson for the Arab Student Association, an engineering and political science student from Libya, Mohammed Abu Falga. We heard briefly from Arnie Arneson, political commentator from New Hampshire, who told us the story of Bernie's exploratory committee, I guess you could call it, showing up on her doorstep in Concord. Then we were joined in the studio by ISU's Director of Sustainability, Mary Rankin, together with her intern, Catherine Lydell. And lastly, reporter Susan Franzen brought us Nick Julesgaard of the Boone Community Theater, starring in the production of Diaries of Adam and Eve. This program will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. with new shows each, and Local Talk gives you new shows each Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. You can also like us on Facebook and get updates on all our show postings in your newsfeed. Thanks to web webmaster Ron Carson for making that possible. Local Talk was engineered by Jonah DeGeest. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was the song Greetings by Hamza El-Din from his CD, A Wish. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoyfm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.